Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 11th of November, Veterans Day. We mark Veterans Day, and we mark the birthday of Abigail Adams today, 265 years old. She was a remarkable, remarkable woman, and we learn a lot more about her today. This hour, the author of Abigail Adams, Woody Holton, is with us, National Book Award finalist for Unruly Americans and the Origins of the Constitution, and a recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship for Abigail Adams. He teaches history at the University of Richmond, and we look at so many different aspects of her life. I didn't know what a money manager she was, and she was able to amassed quite a bit of money and then did some things that were truly revolutionary, writing a will and distributing what she considered to be her property to her primarily female heirs, which was a challenge, of course, to the laws of the time. Woody went through, there is a rich history here that she left in the form of letters, some 2,000 letters to friends. She started doing a lot of these letters when she was a teenager, and then, of course, the rich letters and huge supply of those letters that she wrote to her husband, John Adams. Isn't it amazing she was first lady in the country, her husband was the second president of the United States, and her son was the sixth president? What a position for anybody to have. We have a lot to talk about concerning her life. I'm sure that many of you had a chance to see the fabulous, I thought it was fabulous, HBO special on the Adams family, which really brings history alive in many ways, as does Woody's book. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email address, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hi, Woody. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. Oh, she must have been fun to write about.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is my fourth book and easily the most fun of them to write. The historian Joe Ellis once said of Abigail Adams, she was just incapable of writing a boring letter. And it's really true. It was a lot of fun to spend so much time with her.
I would imagine. I didn't know very much at all about her early life. It sounds like it was, you know, a little dismal growing up with her parents. Her dad didn't sound like a lot of fun.
Yes, and her mom was worse.
Yeah, looking after her all the time.
At least in her eyes. I mean, they both had positive influences. Her father got her exposed to books, even though she didn't get much education as a woman. She did get some at home. And her mom, I really got her started on a charitable pattern, that she really was a very benevolent person in taking care of the widows and other desperate people in her neighborhood. So they had positive influences, but she really saw her mom, to use the modern term, as a control freak.
Right.
There's a wonderful story early on when she's complaining to one of her sisters that her mom wouldn't let her go to the Harvard graduation. You know, it was a day's ride up to Boston, and she thought that would be fun. That was you can kind of see how much time these people have on their hands, you know, without the kinds of entertainment we have, because even if you didn't have anybody graduating, oh, let's go to Harvard graduation. And most of it's in Latin, you know, you don't speak Latin. But her mom wouldn't let her go because, you know, you're going to be around all those other people and you might pick up germs from them. And, of course, one of the ironies of that is, having seen her mother as so controlling, once she was married and had her kids, she was even more so.
Right.
I think all of her own kids would use that phrase for her. Although I would use the more benign term, just she was very self-confident. John Adams is portrayed in that movie and in most other histories and stuff, and I think accurately, as kind of vain and confident. But I think she was even more confident than he was.
Mm-hmm. And of course, her mother, and she had reason to be worried about the health of their children and the health of themselves, because you had all these mass horrendous illnesses taking place all around them.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, by the time of the Revolutionary War, Abigail was appreciating her mother more because of her own kids' illnesses, and her mom saw those kids through a dysentery epidemic in the fall of 1775, and that almost killed Tommy, their youngest son. And the mom, you know, as who was pretty old by that time, came over every single day to help with the kids. And she caught dysentery from one of those kids and died.
Oh.
And so, I think Abigail was a lot more understanding of her mom. Although it is interesting, her mom died on October 1st of 1775. The following summer, Abigail finally got inoculated against smallpox. Hmm. And that was another thing she'd actually resented about her mom, was that John Adams had been inoculated way back in 1764, right before he got married to Abigail. And Abigail wanted to go up to Boston with him and get inoculated, too. And her mother wouldn't let her do that either. And so you're right, there were all these diseases to dread, like smallpox and the throat distemper and dysentery. But her mother was also so worried that she wouldn't let Abigail get inoculated either.
Yeah, that's a fascinating story. And they were writing to each other during this time. Can you tell the inoculation story, John's inoculation story? It's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we have these wonderful love letters carried back and that John and Abigail wrote. And actually, to read them, you'd think they're living hours and hours away from each other, you know, several days' ride. But I actually went and walked it as part of the research for this book. And it's only a couple hours' walk from his house to her house. But they were in such an epistolary culture where people were really into writing letters. They didn't even, somebody just lived right down the street. You might write them a letter, and which is great for us today.
It sure is great for you.
Yeah, I imagine somebody trying to write your or my biography, you know, using our text messages. It's going to be a tough job,
right?
But they do have these wonderful letters. I mean, one interesting thing about when John got inoculated for smallpox, so he went up to Boston for that, and they did keep writing their letters to each other, and that's a little bit further. That's a sort of a morning's ride up to Boston. And those letters were carried by, between Abigail and John, were carried by one of her father's slaves. Hmm. And that's a reminder that, you know, we think of slavery as a Southern institution, and it was never as entrenched up north, but all of the 13 colonies had slavery. And Abigail grew up with slaves and ended up spending a lot of time with some of her father's former slaves after they were freed by the Massachusetts Supreme Court in 1783. But to talk about the smallpox scene, the letters that Tom, her father's slave, brought her from her husband John had to be smoked. Smoked once by John after he'd write a letter and then hold it with tongs over the fire to try to kill the smallpox that was on it. Because he was being inoculated, but in those days, the only way to be inoculated against smallpox was to get a case of smallpox.
Right. Oh, my.
The HBO movie is really good on that because they show people being, you know, their wrists being slit and the smallpox little pus being put in there. Now, you're giving an actual case of it, and so you can understand Abigail's mother's worry because you can die from it, although it's much less likely to kill you than getting it by the natural way.
Right.
Anyway, so he'd have to smoke the letters, and then Tom would carry the letter back to the Smith's parsonage where Abigail lived with her father and mother, the Smiths. And then smoke them again. And she did complain to John that Tom horribly mangled the letters while smoking them for her. But she obviously did appreciate what he was doing for her.
Yeah. The letters that she wrote, even when she was a teenager, are so sophisticated in many ways for a young person who really didn't have formal schooling, a lack of education. Where did that sophistication come from? Just a lot of reading on her own?
Yes, and I think her parents get a lot of credit for that. And she also had the help of a guy named Richard Cranch, who courted her sister for a long time, her sister Mary, and then eventually married Mary. And he, who himself was self-taught, but he had learned several languages, both ancient and modern languages. And he was a philosopher and a prophet who wrote a lot of biblical prophecy kind of stuff. And a real, you know, quirky guy, very impractical, never found any good way of making. I tried all these things, watchmaking and making cards for, and never did well financially, but was a real thinker. And she, in her later life, said it was really Richard Cranch who, as she said, first put books in my hands and taught her to appreciate them. And that was when Richard was courting her sister Mary. Now, I have this impression that what was really happening was that they were giving her books to get rid of her so they could be alone. But that's probably too cynical. Richard really got her, and I think that both made her, as you say, incredibly literate and incredibly self-confident. I did an interview with one of these all-night radio stations, and somebody called in to say, you know, you get these questions at 4 o'clock in the morning. What would Abigail think of 9/11 and Muslim radicals and all that? And I was able to tell this guy actually, she knew all about Islam. She in fact knows more. I think it's fair to say that she knew more about Islam than I do. For instance, she wrote a beautiful letter to John when they were courting about, I wish I could be carried to you on the back of the Al-Barak of Muhammad. And I go, what's Al-Barak? And, you know, went to my copy of the Quran, and there it is, the winged horse that Muhammad could travel on. And so, you know, that's amazing to think that she knew so much about Islam, as well as the traditional stuff that you're supposed to know, Shakespeare and the Roman classics. And she was constantly, you know, she took the name Diana for the goddess of the moon, and he was Lysander, who was a Spartan hero. They were really, some of it is kind of deliberately showing off how learned they are.
Sure.
But she was learned despite her lack of formal education.
She sure was. Tell me more about the age of sensibility, the sensibility and how important that was to the era in which she was particularly growing up and becoming a young woman.
Yeah, age of sensibility is a good way to put it, because I was hunting for the right word. I wanted to almost call it a fad, because she was really obsessed with this idea that, in contrast to what John Locke had said, John Locke, in addition to being a political writer, had written sort of manuals for parents, basically, an essay on the human understanding in particular, saying Locke's idea was that every one of us is born as a blank slate. And that does make parenting so important, because good parents will raise you to be great and bad parents will teach you bad values and all that. But Abigail didn't believe that. She thought that every person was born with an innate, natural feeling that we'd use the word empathy. That word wasn't invented until the late 19th century, but that kind of gets at what she thought people were born with. That, you know, if I see a piano fall on you, Kathleen, it hurts me. It may hurt you more, but it hurts me to see you suffer. And it makes me, if you win the lottery and I'm a friend of yours, or even if I just see somebody win the lottery, that makes me happy. And she was just really obsessed with that idea and judged people by that standard. To what extent did they seem to have that natural sympathy? And, of course, the British didn't. And she sometimes worried that her own husband didn't have it. She wrote him when they were courting that he seemed to be as sturdy as an oak. And on the one hand, that's a compliment. You know, you're a manly man. On the other hand, she wanted him to have a little more of that sensitivity, too. And at one point when he was in France as an American diplomat, she wrote him and said, I think you must have taken on the cold blood of a Laplander, that you've become cold and stiff and callous, as opposed to what you're supposed to be, which is warm and sensitive. And those were really female qualities that she wanted men to have. And this is kind of a sense in which she was a feminist that we don't really think about, that this was a way that she wanted men to be more like women. And she was worried that about two of her children. One of her sons, Charles, had too much sensibility. I mean, she admired his sensibility, and this guy was a real charmer. At the age of 16, when you're courting, you get a ring with a lock of hair from this girl or boy that you're courting. And Charles was known for having pockets full of rings, all with different colors and textures of hair from his different girlfriends. So Charles, her son, had too much sensibility, maybe, and then her daughter, Nabby, she wrote some letters that I would consider kind of mean about Nabby not having enough sensibility, that she seemed to be kind of cold. And so when a guy named Royal Tyler came along, who had a pretty shady past, Abigail didn't know that he'd fathered a child with a cleaning woman while he was a student at Harvard, but she did know that he had a shady past, and yet Abigail really fell for this guy because she thought he was a man of real sensibility and that he would inculcate sensibility in Nabby. And so Abigail really went to bat with John, who was away, and she knew that John would have an opinion about my child, as he called her, falling in love with this guy. But Abigail really advocated for Royal Tyler, at least early on, because maybe he can teach Nabby to have some sensibility.
Huh. Oh, that's fascinating. And what about her mission? Did she see this as her mission, and did John Adams see this as her mission to keep his cynicism at bay?
I'll say yes and no. Certainly that was the case sometimes. But you mentioned the HBO movie. I liked it, too. I think it's especially, as you put it, for keeping history, for making history come alive, you know, right, to be able to see things. And I think the scenery and the costumes and all that were great. The now, there's a lot of fiction in there. You know, they have a naval battle that John Adams was supposedly involved in. That's not true. And you can understand the temptation to fictionalize. But I have a bigger problem with the movie about Abigail. Well, two. One, they never mentioned the Remember the Ladies' Letter, which to me is the thing she's most famous for.
Right.
It's her advocacy of women's rights, which they don't mention. But then there's a deeper problem, which is the movie portrays John as mercurial and emotional, and Abigail is kind of the port in the storm.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read her letters, Abigail's the storm half the time. You know, it's true that John hated at various times Benjamin Franklin, John Hancock, Alexander Hamilton, Thomas Jefferson, I mean, most of the other founding fathers. You know, the one person you couldn't hate is Washington. But even Washington, he was very resentful of the fact that after the Revolutionary War, everybody thought that George Washington had fought the war single-handedly and that nobody else had mattered. And Adams was already worried in 1811 that, you know, there's going to be a Washington monument, but not an Adams monument. And he was right. John had a lot of issues with his fellow founding fathers, but everybody that John hated, Abigail hated more. And I have to say, as much as I admire on so many things, she'd be about the last person I would hire as a diplomat. I think the HBO movie does a great job of portraying John's failures as a diplomat in France, because he was so blunt and he didn't want to play the game. But Abigail would have been worse.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Woody. Abigail Adams, the focus of our conversation on this, her 265th birthday. Woody Holton is our guest, author of a marvelous new book, biography titled Abigail Adams. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Woody teaches history at the University of Richmond and is a National Book Award finalist for Unruly Americans and the Origins of the Constitution. So we'll be with your calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Woody, starting with Amy from Madison. Hi, Amy.
Hi. I was wondering whatever happened with Abigail's will. Did anyone contest it, or were her wishes actually followed?
Yeah, that's a great question. Amy, let me give you a little of the backstory of that. Way back in 1781, Abigail had made a bunch of money during the Revolutionary War selling stuff that her husband had sent her from Europe. He was over there as an American diplomat, and he'd proposed to basically send her checks. They called them bills of exchange in those days. And she said, well, that's fine, but much better would be there's a war on, so everything's expensive. European items are expensive, so send me merchandise instead, and I'll sell it. She made a bunch of money that way and took some of it and set it aside and then grew it in various ways, some of which were kind of unscrupulous, which I can tell you about. But anyway, by the time of her death, she had the modern equivalent of about $100,000 to distribute. And as Kathleen said, she left, well, token gifts to her two sons, but then nothing to her grandsons or nephews. She left it all to her granddaughters and nieces.
Isn't that something?
And I don't think this was an anti-male thing, Kathleen. I think what she was saying was, having made this claim to own property, which the law was very clear and went back for centuries, once a woman gets married, you know, you can be a millionaire, and the second you get married, you own nothing. That's personal property. Real estate, you're technically allowed to own it as a woman, but you can't will it, you can't control it, you can't get the profits, you can't sell it without your husband's permission, so really you're not allowed to own real estate either. So that's why women didn't write wills, because the main purpose of a will is to distribute property, and married women didn't own property. Widows and single women had the same property rights as men, but married women don't write a will because you don't have anything to distribute. And John Adams was very much alive in 1816 when she wrote her will, and in fact, he outlived her. So Amy's question was, what happened with the will? Well, she says at the start of the will that she's distributing this property by and with the consent of John Adams, but his signature is not anywhere on the document. So he would have been completely justified on the eyes of the law when he found this will in his wife's papers and just throwing it in the fire. But to answer Amy's question, he complied with it to the letter. And by doing that, he turned it into a legal document. That is, in the eyes of the law, she had acted as his agent and distributed his property. So he made it real, and I just think that's a there's a lot of things to admire about John Adams, and I think this may be the most admirable. Certainly it's the most amazing of his many collaborations with Abigail. She helped him on a lot of things. She would edit some of his public statements and so forth, and those are cool collaborations. But this one, where it was the wife and not the husband that took the initiative, this is kind of the most amazing of their collaborations, I think.
Hmm. Thank you.
Thanks, Amy, so much for the call. Tell me more about her investing in depreciated government securities. A couple questions. What exactly was that? And did John know what she was doing with this money?
This is another yes and no answer. Oh, and by the way, this is what I was talking about when I said some of her investments are a little unscrupulous. As you know, all of our wars, including the current, who have put our government deep in debt. And that was especially true of the Revolutionary War, since the government had just been created. There were very high taxes during the Revolutionary War, which was one of her struggles, because she's running the farm and she's running the family finances while John is off at Congress and then off in Europe as a diplomat. So there were taxes, but the big way that the war was funded was by going into debt. And that means the soldiers were first paid with something, continental currency, and you may have heard that expression, not worth a continental, because mm-hmm. this money was basically worthless. And so the soldiers were paid again at the end of the war, but still not with real money. They got basically IOUs. You could call them war bonds, similar to our modern savings bonds. But basically they were promissory notes that were the payment that the soldiers received, saying someday the U.S. government's going to give you $300 or whatever for your service in the Army. But the soldiers needed real money right away, and so they exchanged those they were called final settlement certificates. They went out to exchange them, but the people buying those bonds were not going to pay face value. And, in fact, a lot of the soldiers had to sell their bonds for a tenth of the face value. And so, and I have the example of one soldier in the book named Joseph Plum Martin. He just needed to get home. This Army didn't pay your travel expenses home. And he took all of his bonds that he'd received for 6 years in the Army and sold them and got only enough money to pay his travel expenses and a new suit of clothes.
Oh, goodness.
Terrible for the soldiers, but a great opportunity for bond speculators like Abigail.
Really?
Who bought up those bonds at a fraction of the face value and made a killing off of them.
My. And she didn't have any misgivings that she was making a lot of money over other people's misfortune?
She never expressed that, and in fact, she... But she did write about the bond speculators, and she made a case for them, which is, look, if it hadn't been for the speculators being willing to buy these bonds, they would have been worth nothing.
Right.
And so that soldier, like Joseph Plum Martin, he's at least getting something for his bonds. But you're absolutely right, Kathleen, that John Adams was very skeptical about this idea. He wanted to invest his money in land. That was the real thing. You know, the enemy can burn your farm, but not the land under it. So it's a much safer investment. He was almost like, you know, there's this line in Gone with the Wind where Scarlett O'Hara's father says, you know, land's the only thing worth fighting for and dying for. And you don't think of John Adams and Scarlett O'Hara together, but John had that attitude. He really saw himself as a farmer.
Mm-hmm.
And land is safer for the country as well as for the individual, because these bond speculators are this special interest group that are that have both the means and the motive for influencing the government. So he wanted to be like these Roman senators whose political independence was guaranteed by their economic independence. And so he really was into owning land. And Abigail said, well, that's all well and good, and I'll be a dutiful wife if that's what you want to do, is invest in land. But you're land is making about a 1% annual return on your investment. And if we buy these bonds, I can get you 24.
Oh, my gosh, 24.
24% annual
wow.
return on investment. Yeah, oh, that was one of her bonds and others. Others, some of them did better and some did worse. But she really made a killing in the bond market. You could call her a junk bond trader, but she made a killing for him. And then one of the amazing, there was a great moment in the researching this because I saw that the Massachusetts Historical Society seemed to have a receipt indicating how much John's, the volume of his bonds, and so I emailed my friend up there saying, can you dig around and see if you can find this receipt that shows John Adams getting these bonds? And my friend emailed back, said, I haven't found that receipt to John yet, but I did find a receipt made out to Abigail Adams. Would that interest you at all? And that's where I first got the indication that she not only was buying bonds on John's behalf, but she'd also started buying them on her own behalf as well. And this is the money that eventually went into her will.
Huh, remarkable. Let's go to Margaret from Sun Prairie. Hello, Margaret.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, Margaret.
Hi. I was listening to your explanation of John Adams being in France, and I was thinking of the feminist movement in France. Was very popular. I could have my centuries mixed up, but was there any influence between the French philosophy and Abigail's philosophy over here?
That is a great question, and you don't have your centuries mixed up at all. There had been a lot of feminist writing, women expressing feminist views in France, but I don't think I can say that Abigail was much influenced by that. That is, that a lot of her boldest statements in favor of women's rights came before she'd been exposed to those French feminists. And I even have to say that when she finally came over to Europe herself in 1784 to join John, and they spent, actually just 9 months in France before he settled in as American ambassador to England. And she was kind of appalled by the women of France. They were a little too much for her. And that's a reminder that although she was a feminist in so many ways, especially when it came to the education of women, and she really felt cheated. Although she'd been able to educate herself to a great extent, she really felt cheated out of an education. And you know, you can see it in her orthography and her grammar and so forth, that she really had not had a formal education, and she was always understandably resentful about that. So she was a feminist in that. She clearly was a feminist in her believing that a married woman should own property, but she was appalled at the French opera, for instance. I mean, these women dancing around wearing, in her eyes, almost nothing. You know, we'd say we wouldn't take a second glance at it now. But and some of these women who were, there was a woman named Madame Helvetius who Benjamin Franklin hung out with and had proposed to at one point, and Abigail was just aghast at her. And this woman does sound pretty brassy. She'd sort of put her arms around both men on both sides of her at the dinner table, including John Adams. and well, my favorite of these stories was they were sitting around, Abigail and John and Madame Helvetius, and she had this lap dog who peed on the floor. Oh. And she reached down, Mrs. Helvetius did, with her dress and wiped up
the
pee.
Oh, no.
So you could kind of see how, you and I would be appalled, and she was even more so by some of these French women.
It's a great story. Thank you, Margaret. Unless you have more.
Welcome.
Oh, okay. What about these letters she wrote? I can't remember. Catherine McCauley, was that her name? And who's the other woman she wrote? She had admired. Can you tell about those women?
Yes, and actually, you're reminding me one other thing to say in response to Margaret's question. One European feminist who she really was positively influenced by was Mary Wollstonecraft, who wrote in 1791 a book called Vindication of the Rights of Women.
Hmm.
The way it comes up in the correspondence is John says something sexist in one of his letters and realized what he'd done and said, "Oh, pardon me, disciple of Wollstonecraft." And Abigail wrote back saying, "Not a disciple, but a pupil of Wollstonecraft."
Hmm.
But she and her sisters were influenced by Wollstonecraft. And that's a reminder, you know, that she, in some sense, may be the tip of an iceberg, that her sisters wrote some pretty proto-feminist letters, too. that indicate that there were a lot of women of that era who had attitudes similar to hers, and we're just not seeing it because their letters don't survive to the same extent as hers. But you're asking about Catherine McCauley. She's another one who was kind of ended up being a disappointment to Abigail when she finally met her. She was thrilled to know about this woman in England who was a historian and had written a history of England that was very well regarded by men as well as women. But then when Abigail met her, by the time Abigail had met her, she had lost her first husband and married a new husband who was 20 years younger than her and a surgeon's mate on a ship. So she'd married down in both senses, and Abigail just couldn't handle that.
20 years younger.
Yeah.
That must have been something in those years. It
you
still
mentioned
is
that
now.
All the time, but women weren't supposed to do that.
Right. Oh, that's quite something.
And another woman historian who she was much more intimate with was Mercy Otis Warren, who, like her, lived in Massachusetts and had a husband who was involved in the Revolution there, and started off as a great, I'd say disciple of Mercy Otis Warren. She really worshipped Mercy Otis Warren, and you can see in the letters that she wrote Mercy, she's trying to kind of mimic her writing style, which was a mistake because Mercy Warren, A, you should never try to copy anybody's writing style, but then B, Mercy Warren was a pretty awkward writer, and Abigail tried her best to be like her, but that friendship actually was frayed by a bunch of different things. Mercy Warren opposed the Constitution, which Abigail strongly supported, and she kind of fell into the orbit of John Hancock, who was an enemy of the Adamses. And worst of all, in 1805, she published The History of the Revolution, in which she had lots of mean things to say about John Adams. And, of course, that was unforgivable. Abigail did eventually forgive her, but John never did. He said, "History is not the province of the ladies."
What?
He said that. He never said that before this woman historian had trashed him, of course.
She must have really trashed him.
Yeah. She was one of the people who promoted the notion that John had monarchical tendencies. And he was conservative, but it's unfair to call him a monarch. But this is the thing, you know, the sexism comes out when a woman criticizes you. Why couldn't he just criticize her and not all women history writers?
Yeah. I was interested in when you describe contrasting loyalties in families, some who were just still tied to the crown and didn't want a revolution, and sometimes the wives or sometimes the husbands had different political perspectives. Did that surface at all in Abigail's family or in John's family?
Yeah, let's see. There was a Quincy. So, yeah, she had, that would be a cousin, I guess. One of her cousins, the husband and wife, disagreed on politics. And, in fact, on the war, and the husband eventually left and went to England, and the wife stayed behind.
Mm.
And there were other examples of this, too. And that's why I argue in my book, this is a great debate among historians of women in the American Revolution, but I argue that the sort of practical impacts of the revolution on women were greater than the ideological impacts. That is, Abigail was able to use John's own words against him. For instance, he'd once written, and this is kind of a cliche, all men would be tyrants if they could. And he wrote it in the context of, you know, so therefore we can't give Parliament unlimited power over the colonies. But she quoted it back to him in the famous Remember the Ladies letter, all men would be tyrants if they could. And she actually argued that women didn't have the same tyrannical tendencies that men had. And if women had the power to be tyrants over men, they wouldn't do it, that there was something inherently better about women. But she was influenced by the ideas of the revolution, but like her cousin Quincy, she was influenced more by the practicalities of it, I think. And so having John gone for those 10 years and running the farm.
Long time.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Oh, and it was distressing. And I think this is where the HBO movie is really good, that just shows her just really torn up by that extended separation and by his not writing a lot of the time during that. On the other hand, it really allowed her to become a whole person. And other wars have done this. You know, even the Civil War, which, you know, you don't think of the South as having a progressive ideology, but these Southern women running the farms gained some of that same confidence during the Civil War that she gained during the Revolutionary War.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk to Brandy from Madison. Hi, Brandy.
Hi. I have been reading The Hemings of Monticello by Annette Gordon Reed.
Right, right.
And she describes the pretty icy or almost unfriendly attitude that Abigail Adams had towards Sally Hemings. So my question is what was Abigail's attitude towards slavery? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Brandy.
Good question. She, as I said, grew up with slaves, but very early in her married life became an opponent of slavery and recognized the hypocrisy and emphasized it in letters to John of how can we be fighting for our liberty while holding slaves. And so I think that was probably part of her distaste for Sally Hemings was the mere fact that Sally was a slave and she just didn't believe in slavery. On the other hand, it's also true that there were lots of people who were anti-slavery, but also anti-black, that is racially prejudiced. And that's one where Abigail really went back and forth. About the same time that she met Sally Hemings and had such disparaging things to say about her, almost a child herself, she called her at age 14. She wanted Sally Hemings to be sent home. Sally Hemings came over to England on the way to France where to go work in her owner Thomas Jefferson's house. She came as the nursemaid to Thomas Jefferson's daughter, and they stopped over in England on the way over, and Abigail wrote Jefferson saying, this slave girl, Sally, should be sent home. And it is interesting to imagine how Jefferson's later life might have been different if he'd listened to Abigail,
right?
Because when he returned from France in 1789, he returned with Sally Hemings, who was pregnant by him.
And also her comments, wasn't it also in England where she saw a performance of Othello?
Yeah, this to me is the real low point of Abigail Adams. She saw the play Othello, which a black general has a white wife, she wasn't horrified by the fact that he was suckered into thinking that she was cheating on him and killed her. That wasn't what bothered Abigail. What bothered him was the fact that a black man was married to a white woman. And she described, to quote her disgust and horror at seeing the fair Desdemona being touched by this sooty guy. Now, the guy who touching her was actually literally sooty because it was a white guy.
Mm.
The actor was the brother of the actress who played Desdemona. So it wasn't actually an African guy, but the whole idea of a black man and a white woman was just horrifying to her. And what she wrote, it's the sort of thing you'd see in a Ku Klux Klan pamphlet today.
Yeah.
On the other hand, that same Abigail Adams in 1797, so just 10 years later, wrote John about they had a servant boy named James, worked in their stables, wanted to go to the local school, and went for a while, and then the parent of one of the white kids came and said, we don't want this black boy in our school. And she really stood up to him and said, look, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, and really went to bat. And sort of looks like Martin Luther King saying, let that kid be in school. So depending on the context, interracial sex she couldn't handle, but going to bat for this young man who was really a part of her family, she could handle. And Phoebe was a really, she just wanted
to talk more about Phoebe.
Yeah, Phoebe had been one of her father's slaves. And when Abigail went to England to join her husband in 1784, she put Phoebe and her husband in her house rent-free. And they did a great job of taking care of it. And they were very poor. Phoebe was already old by that time and didn't have much of an opportunity, having been a slave, to learn how to earn her own living. And so even after Abigail returned, she always had Phoebe in one of the Adams properties staying way below market rent. But one of the interesting things about this, having received this charity from Abigail, Phoebe insisted on taking in other people who were even more desperate than herself. Both black and white homeless people would stay at that house. And every time Abigail found out about it, she would send a message to Phoebe saying, you can't do that. I'm happy to have you be in that house, but I don't want this riffraff, these people I don't know, staying there as well. And each time that Abigail did that, Phoebe stood up to her and insisted on extending charity of her own. And it was an ongoing conflict between them. And I kind of imagine it as sort of grumpy old women as they have this battle. But I just think it's very cool that Phoebe, despite having spent most of her life as a slave,
on
the hook to Abigail, stood up to her.
Woody Holton is our guest this hour, and we're talking about the life of Abigail Adams. It's the subject of Woody's new book. She is the subject of Woody's new book. And our phone number is 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, it's talk@wpr.org. And amazingly enough, kind of like symbolism, we are speaking on her 265th birthday. Is that cool or what? More phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to phone calls, and join us if you'd like. I'll give you the number once again, 800-486-8655. John from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Good morning. I was wondering if your guest happened to view the DVD on the John Adams. It's a miniseries. I'm currently watching that slowly, but I'm getting through it. And I noticed that Abigail, she makes a couple of disparaging remarks to her husband about nothing anti-slavery in the Declaration of Independence. And I'm wondering if that's accurate, or if most of what's in there is accurate.
A lot of that movie is fiction. I mentioned a Navy battle in which they even have John grabbing his own gun and firing at the British ship, and I was kind of waiting for them to have that shot sink the British ship, which they didn't go that far, but that battle didn't happen. Which you understand some of that fictionalization that they do. The particular scene that you're talking about is half true. Abigail, in July 1776, was up in Boston, finally being inoculated. Her mother having died the previous fall, she now could go ahead and get inoculated, and there was a big epidemic of smallpox going on, so she was getting inoculated against smallpox. And John sent her an early copy of the Declaration of Independence. We don't know exactly which version it was. And then she saw the went out and to hear the final version being read from the steps of the State House. And as she contrasted the two documents, she wrote him saying, I regret that the second one doesn't have some of the manly sentiments, as she put it, that were in the original draft that I was sent. And so I think it's a fair inference by David McCulloch, whose book that movie's based on, that's one of the things she regretted being taken out. The other possibility, though, is just that she thinks that she thought the original version, it was in John's handwriting, so she thought it had been written by John. And she noticed all the changes, and so she was trying to flatter his ego by saying, oh, they shouldn't have edited this thing that you wrote. But now I think it's a fair inference that's correct, because she was anti-slavery, and that would have been upsetting that the denunciation of slavery in the original rough draft was taken out. In fairness, though, I should also emphasize that Jefferson didn't say, okay, therefore we should abolish slavery. Mm-hmm. He was just trying to blame the British for the slave trade.
Right. And he had slaves, too, of course.
Of course. Absolutely. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks so much for your call, John. And what about the movie almost seemed to infer that she had a crush on Thomas Jefferson. Did she?
She called him one of the great ones of the world. I don't remember the exact phrase in a second. She admired him a lot. But no, I wouldn't say a crush.
No. And did they have a big falling out?
They did. This is one of those cases where, as I said, all these people that he made enemies with, she became more enemies of. And Jefferson was a Republican and Adams was a Federalist. It started with that, but it really came when Jefferson succeeded Adams as president, and Adams made all these midnight appointments to try to stuff the federal bureaucracy and the judiciary with his own people. And Jefferson really felt sandbagged, that he had all these people that he's either going to have to fire them and get in trouble for that, or have people implementing his policies who disagreed with his policies. And so John and Jefferson broke over that, and Abigail just followed John into that. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting thing, Kathleen, that most of her enemies were simply John's enemies that she adopted. The only enemies that she really had herself were women who had accepted charity from her, and that ended up going poorly. For instance, Abigail's brother, William Smith, was at least verbally abusive and probably physically abusive and abandoned his family and drank himself to death. Mm. And so Abigail took in one of his daughters and did things like send used clothes and stuff to his wife, her sister-in-law. Catherine Louisa Smith became very resentful of Abigail and her sisters that they weren't doing enough for her. And this also was true of one of Abigail's daughters-in-law, who had married Charles, and Charles had also drunk himself to death, which makes you think that there's actually a possibility that the susceptibility to alcoholism ran in that family.
Yes.
And after Charles drank himself to death, Abigail did what she could for Sally, his widow, but had some real conflicts with Sally. And I do think that's interesting that her two biggest conflicts that were generated by herself rather than following John were with people that had taken charity from her. Because, as you know, nobody likes to be the recipient of charity, and it can actually create not gratitude but resentment.
Right. She did take in a lot of people, though. She gave a lot, didn't she?
She did. And actually, we were talking about how did she feel any guilt about being a junk bond trader. She did make a point, and one of the times that she was explaining to her business agent that she wanted to buy some more bonds, she said, "This will create a fund for my pensioners." Hmm. And her pensioners were these people, almost all of them women, mostly widows, that she would send a cord of firewood or some meat help them in various ways. That's a tradition she'd learned from her mother. And frankly, it looked early in her life like she wasn't going to be able to continue that tradition because she married down. Both of her parents had wanted her to not marry John, and nothing personal against him. Well, he's a lawyer, but lawyers are kind of in bad odor. But more, it was a financial thing that he wouldn't be able to support her. But she was able to continue her mother's charitable tradition, mostly through money that she made herself.
Don't you love those stories? We don't think much of him, and then he turns out to be the president.
Yeah, exactly.
We were wrong.
Right.
Sorry. Alan from West Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I had a question for your author about all these various versions, and which of the more recently published books is more fiction and which is more accurate? I'm assuming yours is the most accurate.
Of
that's
course.
Correct.
Woody's has got the truth.
Script, Alan. I teach a class on Abigail Adams, and we read two different biographies of her. Not mine, believe it or not. I don't assign my own. And I think that's the only answer to your question, Alan, is to read two against each other and try to figure out which one is most supported by evidence. And that's actually a plug I could put in. There's a site that you could Google called Adams Electronic Archive.
Wait, Adams Electronic Archive?
Yeah, link to that, Kathleen. That'd be great. Oh. That's every single letter that John and Abigail wrote to each other. And actually, from that, you can link over to another site, also a free site, that has every letter that Abigail wrote everybody else up through the year 1787.
Oh, wonderful.
On that one.
Wonderful.
And so read a couple different versions and read the letters themselves and see what you think.
Well, I think it's perfectly okay for you to use your book in your class. You know your book. You know it intimately. Why not use that as a text?
I did do that once with my very first book. I thought the students were kind of resentful. You know, they thought I was getting all the money. And some of the students didn't like it. And the other thing is, Kathleen, I realized that by signing my own book, I just gave up 5 lectures.
Oh, right. I see your point. So who's next? As you delve into her life, I would think that you get captivated by somebody else.
Well, I got asked that question on a blog from the New York Times and had the great pleasure of giving them the answer that I'll give you, which is nothing.
Nothing.
I have a 3-year-old little girl and less than 1-year-old little boy. So
oh, my gosh.
I'm having a lot of fun writing nothing at all right now.
You can write a few children's. There you go. A little children's book about Abigail Adams.
Uh-huh. It's been done. I actually haven't read them. I should go check out. And actually, somebody told me there's a new series of kids, maybe juvenile books, but in which Abigail Adams solves mysteries.
Ooh.
So there you go.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I just love the way you wrote it, and she's so fascinating. Thanks for the book. It was great.
I appreciate it, and thanks for the great calls, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do have great callers. Woody Holton is the author. The book is Abigail Adams, and today is Abigail Adams' 265th birthday. Woody is a National Book Award finalist for Unruly Americans and the Origins of the Constitution, and is a recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship for Abigail Adams. He teaches history at the University of Richmond, and we thank him for a really interesting hour, wasn't it? She's worth knowing about. A lot of people are. She really is. Thank you to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for being our on-air producer. Thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network.